We're talking about how certain cities have inspired artists. Memphis is famous for its music. You might call it the birthplace of the blues, rock and roll, and soul. One man in the 50s who helped disseminate this music was a DJ named Dewey Phillips.
Yes, sir, let's all stay tuned for the hottest thing in the country, Pop Chop, coming to you through WHBQ-TV and WHBQ-Radio. They don't make no show, and none better, bar none. Am I right, Dizzy?
That's right. Tell them about it. I'm with you, partner. I'm with you, partner. I'm with you, Diz. You better believe it.
Music writer Robert Gordon writes about Dewey Phillips and the history of Memphis music in a book called It Came From Memphis. It's a very personal take on the culture that shaped Gordon himself. He told Steve Paulson that he's always been drawn to music that's slipping under the radar of mainstream culture.
It's very easy to visit Memphis and never find your way into this original world, the sort of world that grew from the people in the Delta coming to the city and this mix of country and city and rich and poor and black and white. And that's what I like. I like that exchange that happens in small, dark places.
Are you talking about clubs in particular or just all over?
Just kind of generally all over. I first kind of started on this course in 1975 or 6 or 7. The Rolling Stones played a huge outdoor stadium in Memphis on the 4th of July, hot as could be. And they were supposed to go on at, you know, 6 p.m. Well, they didn't know that, you know, at 6 p.m. it was, you know, going to be 105 degrees out, and so they didn't want to play. They wanted to wait till after dark, not knowing that after dark it would only be 103. So while these 55,000 people waited in the heat, they sent a car and they brought Furry Lewis, this bottleneck blues player, to come kind of fill the gap. And I remember being in the field and hearing this sound and turning around. And I was a teenager, young teenager, and I realized that this music I'd been sort of aware of on record was actually alive, and not only alive, but alive in my town. And about a year later at my high school, someone went and picked up Furry Lewis and brought him out, and he played on the porch at lunchtime, and we passed a hat. And I found out who the upperclassman was who brought him. I said, "How'd you do that?" And he gave me a phone number. And I went to the school phone and called Furry Lewis. And that afternoon, I wasn't old enough to drive yet. I got a ride over to Furry's house. And that was sort of my entrance into this world below the radar, as it were.
Now, that's sort of an amazing story. I mean, here you were going to a suburban school, right?
Right
outside of Memphis, you know, white kid.
And
then somehow hooking up with this old blues guy. I mean, you might think that there would be a big cultural divide there.
Well, Furry was a gracious host. What I became aware of was that Furry and other old black blues artists had been exchanging culture with younger white artist hippie types. So when I showed up as a kid, I was sort of just another one of those guys.
And I'm going to Brownville, Moon, take that right-hand road.
You've written that Furry Lewis could express the world with a single note.
And what that is about the note and the space before and after the note.
Lord, I ain't gonna stop walking till I get my baby's door.
Furry could let a note hang and hang, and you'd be waiting, and then when it would happen, it was just, you know, pure joy.
And that woman I love ain't got great long curly hair. Woman got great long curly hair, but a mother and father do not love me there.
So what was it like for you as a kid, a high school kid, to go out and go to Furry Lewis's house?
Well, it was, you know, the mid-70s, and eventually, you know, I turned 16, I got a driver's license. At that time, there weren't photo IDs, so I had a fake ID. I could buy whiskey at the store and bring it to Furry's house.
What did you do? Did you just sort of hang out and talk, or did he play?
I'd show up. He lived in a duplex, and you walked into his bedroom, and then there was a little, like, alcove and then a kitchen. Very small. Furry would be sitting up on the bed. He had a wooden leg at the knee. It would be off a lot of times, and ladies were there. Furry had the ladies. He was, you know, in his 70s at the time, and he had lady friends. And I learned, you know, to call in advance and tell him I was coming, ask him if I could bring anything besides whiskey, just that was kind of like the barter to get in the door. And then often he would ask for an uncooked hamburger from Wendy's. So we'd always say, cook it a little bit, cook it a little bit. And then...
Why did he want an uncooked hamburger from Wendy's?
The way he liked him, I guess. I don't know. Then to get him to play, you'd have to give him some money. I didn't get it at the time. You know, I was trying. And so Furry would let me stay, but Furry was there and some ladies were sitting around and I had brought a couple guys I'd met on the street from France who were touring. And we started talking about, well, you know, can you play? Yeah, I can play. Let's get a bottle of whiskey, Furry said. And, you know, we pulled up enough money for a half pint. And Furry, you know, had the guitar out and he played a little bit and said, you know what, I got the rheumatism today. I don't feel like playing. And, you know, looking back, I realized, oh, dummy, you know,
you didn't quite bring enough money there.
Didn't, exactly, exactly. And that really has informed my attitude since then. I work a lot with documentary filmmakers who come through town and I do various kind of interviewing. And I always try to make a financial exchange occur. Because publicity doesn't pay utility bills.
That's a fascinating question because journalists, I mean, that's what you are basically. Journalists are not really supposed to be trading money to be able to interview people. But you're saying that when you're dealing with this scene, you need to.
Absolutely. And especially people who are not active anymore but who were active. All these people have is their stories. So it's not like we can say, hey, do this and you'll get a whole bunch of gigs after that. Well, they're not doing gigs anymore.
You know, one thing I find interesting about this whole story about how you came to appreciate the blues in someone like Furry Lewis is you grew up in the era of rock and roll.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the blues were kind of history at
this
point.
Well, not only rock and roll, but the best rock and roll. I grew up in Memphis where Mudboy and the Neutrons played. You know, they were so good they barely made records.
Listen to the sound of my voice tonight. You might be out there riding along in your automobile. You might be out there somewhere in the suburbs in Babylon. I want you to reach out, put your hand on the radio. I want you to let me know, can you feel it? Can you feel it? That's the cosmic countdown, baby. That's the tick-tock of time, and it's running out. Fair has got nothing to do with it.
My book, It Came From Memphis, keeps going back to this player and producer from Memphis named Jim Dickinson. He sort of becomes a through character. And Jim has a saying, let's see if I can get it right. The best songs don't get recorded. The best records don't get released. The best releases don't get played. Something like that, you know? Hmm. And it's sort of, you know...
Because by the time they get recorded, corporate America has settled in. I mean, it's sort of, they've been packaged.
Yeah, yeah. And people are looking for the familiar. And so the unfamiliar gets left behind. You know, that's a lot of what Memphis is about. My Memphis. You know, a different way of looking at things. When Elvis walked into Sun Studio and made That's All Right, Mama... They had been recording for hours and not hit their mark. And Elvis was goofing around in front of his two sidemen to keep them inspired. And Sam Phillips was, you know, in the control room and he heard this sound. He said, what are you doing? Come back inside and do that. You know, it's what you were not looking at that is the important thing.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Anyway, do.
Well, now, there's another town in Tennessee that's famous for music, Nashville. What's the difference between Memphis and Nashville?
Again, to quote my friend Jim Dickinson, Memphis and Nashville are just 200 miles away, but they're a world apart. And you can feel it in the drive coming down from Nashville. It's like Tennessee is this big hill, this big tilt, and all the water is sort of washing into Memphis. And there's, when you cross the Tennessee River, I think it's called the Cumberland Plateau, the air changes. I swear to you, you know, you could feel it if you had your windows down and the air conditioning off. You know, you could feel the air change, and it goes from mountain air to delta air, and the delta is a swamp. You know, Memphis is a swamp.
But you're not just talking about Memphis is blues country and Nashville is country music. Is it more that Nashville is more a company town and Memphis is something else?
It certainly has, yes. But is that because of the air? I mean, Nashville's music industry is built around a life insurance company, right? A life insurance company was the one that sponsored the Grand Ole Opry. Memphis, you know, as a music place, was always where people would get a room in a hotel and go do basically what they called field recordings. They would set up a temporary studio and bring people in to record there. When you walked into Sam Phillips's label, if he was going to record you, he told the guys, whoever he was recording, he said, "Now, I know you think I want to hear what your boss man wants to hear, but I don't want to hear that. I want to hear what you want to play." There was a grit that he was looking for, that he wouldn't quit until he got. That applies to Howlin' Wolf as much as it does to Elvis Presley or anybody. There's an emotion in all this stuff that I think ultimately comes down to racial collision in Memphis. Everything in Memphis comes down to racial collision, and from that springs this stuff. Now, in other words,
that's what makes the music good, is this collision of the races.
Yes, I think so, absolutely. Collision is sort of that similar idea. It says, look, you know, people are different, cultures are different. We can share a same space, but let's recognize that we're different, that people are different. Kind of jumping here, tangential, but here's my definition of soul music, right? In the 60s, you had white guys who were trying to play black music. You had black guys who were trying to play white music. Well, the sort of country inflection of the white guys prevented them from properly playing the blues. The sort of gospel blues inflection of the black guys prevented them from playing smoothly. That was the 50s. When the children of these guys got together in the 60s, they found they knew the same songs, but they played them differently.
Is that the story of Elvis? That's the common image.
In a way, yeah. But so it's when what I think is interesting, even more than Elvis, is like the early days of Stax, when black guys and white guys got together and said, okay, hey, look, we know these same songs. We know them differently. And the bridge they built in connecting their two worlds, that's soul music. And that's sort of, in a way, that's Memphis. You know, that's the one side of the coin, and the other is Dr. King being assassinated there. And they're both related.
Robert Gordon's books include It Came from Memphis and Can't Be Satisfied, a biography of Muddy Waters. We talked with Steve Paulson.